Hello. Welcome to today's audio networking call offered by the Office on Violence Against Women in partnership with Praxis International. My name is Lucy Pope, and I'll be your host for today's call. Also on the call is Liz Carlson. She's a program specialist at Praxis that some of you may know. Let me start by saying that we're really interested in your participation on this call. We love it when you have questions or share your experiences or comments about today's topic. So we invite you to jump into the conversation at any point. We love to keep this casual and hear what you are thinking about all of this. So in order to eliminate the background noise, however, all the lines will be muted throughout the call. So there's two ways that you can participate. You can press the number 1 on your phone keypad, and Stephanie, the operator, will bring you into the call. Or you can email liz@praxisinternational.org, and she can bring your comment or question to the presenters. Let's see. I should also let you know that Praxis has had some technical problems lately with their phone. Liz calls them the shenanigans. So if you happen to be cut off, please just dial back in, and it's not you. All right, so today's session is assessing for racial disparity in your community's response to domestic violence. We're so fortunate to have two experts leading our discussion today, Cheryl Beardsley from Praxis, and our guest on this call, Kristen Weber from the Center for the Study of Social Policy. So let's get to know them a little bit better. Cheryl, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, thank you, Lucy. I have been around for a long time. I started my work in one of the first shelters for battered women in the nation when we were lucky enough to kind of make it up as we went along and do what we felt was right for women. And subsequent to that, have done mental health work with survivors of violence for a number of years, and now I'm back, lucky enough to be working with Praxis. And I've had the good fortune to work with Kristen we're doing a project called the Blueprint for Safety, which is developing domestic violence policy throughout criminal justice response. And as an adjunct to that, are developing a monograph on disparity of impact and addressing that in communities. So I've gotten to know Kristen a little bit, and I know that you all will gain a great deal from her expertise and the experience that she's had doing this work, and I'm very happy to be here and to be talking about this today. I expect to learn a great deal myself.
Exactly. Thank you, Cheryl. And Kristen, could you introduce yourself?
Sure. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Kristen Weber, and I have been working at the Center for the Study of Social Policy for about 9 years now. I'm trained as an attorney, and I used to represent kids in a variety of different capacities out in San Francisco, mostly in child welfare, but also other kinds of foster care, probate guardianships, et cetera. About 7 years ago, we connected with Praxis to do some work on what was then called the audit, which is now called the institutional analysis, and have been using that process ever since.
That's great. Right. Yes, we're so excited to learn what you've figured out here about this. And thank you all on the lines for joining us today. Before we get started, we need to give a very quick overview of this method. This is going to be very familiar to many of you, but we also know that there are often new people who join us on these calls. So very briefly, we're talking about community assessments or an institutional analysis, sometimes known as an audit or best practice assessment. Today, I think we tend to use the term IA on this call. So this method is a way of looking at the work we do by analyzing the practice used in a community system or in an institution. Most often we hear about assessments of the criminal justice system, their response to domestic violence or sexual assault, but an IA is also used in other institutions such as the child welfare or child protective system. What we're talking about is a way of looking at how institutions are organized to meet people's needs and to find out how closely they're meeting those needs or whether there's a gap between what it is that people need, like safety, and what institutions actually provide. One of the distinctive things about this method is that it really avoids pointing fingers or blaming people or blaming individual practitioner. It moves away from the focus on they don't get it, they don't care, they don't understand, and it moves us to really looking at how the work is put together, how it's organized around concepts, around policies, around work practices, around the way that different workers and different systems and people are linked together. So there's this emphasis on working side by side as practitioners and systems. People who work in a particular system, whether it's child welfare or 911 or family court, these practitioners working alongside community-based advocates are posing questions and exploring how our work is put together. We do this through a variety of activities. We create a map of each step a case takes as it moves through the system. We do interviews, both focus groups and individual interviews. We look at a lot of case files, documents, policies, and we put all of that data together and build recommendations and identify actions we can take to implement those recommendations. So today we're going to learn about how the Center for the Study of Social Policy has used IA to look very closely at racial disparity in the child protection system. As a TA provider, they've really designed some very thoughtful ways to successfully tackle this kind of complex, sensitive question. So with that very brief background, let's get started, and I'll turn it over to you, Cheryl.
I want to say first that I think that what the Institute for the Center for Study of Social Policy has done with regarding to kind of, for lack of a better word, customizing this approach in a way that helps deal with the sensitivity around racial disparity is really quite sophisticated and fascinating.
Yes.
And Kristen, maybe you could start by saying a little bit about how communities make a decision to engage in looking at racial disparity in systems, whether it be child protection or domestic violence or whatever.
Sure, sure. Well, over the 7 years that we've been working with you, with Praxis, and then on our own doing this work, we've worked with about 14 different jurisdictions, and each jurisdiction goes about making the decision in a slightly different way, but there's some sort of themes on how they go about doing this. One is that it could be a small group of dedicated folks who are consistently worried about and raising the issue that collective intervention, institutional intervention, isn't working for a particular population. The populations we've primarily focused on are African American or Latino families, but another jurisdiction we're working with more recently are talking about different tribal groups as well. But that it's just a small group of people who are very consistent and very vocally raising this to the point that finally someone decides we have to appease them. So let's try something like an institutional analysis approach to sort of see what's happening. Another way that communities end up making this decision is that they get a new leader, a fresh leader, or a leader that in some ways just decides one day they want to take this on. And they follow what their leader says to do. And it's usually the head of the child welfare system, the head of the juvenile justice system. Those are the systems we work primarily with, that has made this decision and maybe has some political comfort in being able to make that decision. Either they have a long tenure or they've come in with a new mayor, something like that. And another way that communities make this decision just to sort of start this process is that a foundation or government agency says, we'll give you money. And so they decide, well, if we can get some money to do this, we'll do it. And they kind of don't know necessarily exactly what they're getting into, but decide that they're going to do that. And so that's sort of how they make the decision to actually do it, sort of the decision about what population they're going to look at or how they're going to go, what area of the system that they want to take a deeper look at. That then is a different question, but they start to do that in somewhat the same way. We lead people through the same process, which is to always start with what their quantitative data says. What do their numbers say? Asking them to break out by different decision points and how a case is processed through an institution. What does it look like in terms of how many families of how many African American families are reported to the child welfare system? How many white families? How many Latino families? How many Asian families? Whatever the population breakdown is in that community, we ask them to talk about that. Then of those families, how many are investigated? How many of their cases are then what we call in child welfare substantiated, meaning that they found that there was child abuse and neglect? How many cases then are kids removed? How long do kids stay in out-of-home care? How many kids end up going home? So those are the different decision points, and it goes on and on. And we ask them to look at that quantitatively. Who is faring the worst? Who has the worst outcomes? And then we spend some time talking to leaders in terms of what are the populations you're worried about, the populations you don't think are faring as well. And usually, just by talking to people, they instinctively know what their quantitative data shows, even if they've never collected this quantitative data to begin with. But it's that combination of talking to people and the quantitative data that starts to get people on board to understanding that there's a population of people that is faring worse than other populations.
So you're using data in some ways to help build buy-in, which may not be as much of an issue if you have a leader on board, but if it's a small group of people who are trying to do this or there's some funding around, sometimes that's a challenge, getting buy-in from all the people you need buy-in from.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Well, so buy-in, I think, is one of the most critical factors of even being able to do this and do this well. Because you don't just need having an agency leader who's saying, we do this, directs people to cooperate with you, but doesn't necessarily direct people to cooperate with you in a fully open way.
Yeah, well said.
And, you know, so there's two kind of things that when you're trying to build buy-in, which we work in, at a minimum, 6 months of just prep time to really explain to people what is the process that they're going to go through and why we're doing this, that there's two sort of camps or things that people have in their head that we work to dispel. One is that people are convinced that you're out to find individual workers as racist because you're talking about there's a group that's faring worse. It's usually a group of color, and that therefore then in their mind they're thinking, you're saying that I am discriminating against people. And so it's really explaining to them what the institutional analysis process is and that it's a process that's trying to understand how an institution is responding or not responding to people who are and we're just examining the people and their stories and their experiences with the system and then how the system is organized. We only ask to follow workers that the system is considering to do their job well. So we're not looking for the workers who are the superstars or the workers who are the duds or the people who do sort of egregious things. And then, so we spend a lot of time leading them through. We really are just trying to see, follow your system functioning the way it's supposed to be functioning and still producing bad outcomes for particular populations. That takes a lot of careful conversation for people, but once you have that conversation enough, people start to nod and get it. But then there's this other group of people who kind of think that, you know, we're colorblind, we're race neutral. These are race neutral policies, these are colorblind policies. And why are you saying we need to change this? Because isn't that fair? Sort of this assumption that everything is equal, so therefore everything is fair. And in fact, and this is a little bit in the paper that we've been working on, Cheryl, is that's one assumption or one way of thinking, but the other way of thinking is more about equity. And then that's what we start to talk to people about is this concept of equity. And that sometimes being equitable, meaning you're trying to make sure everybody has equitable or the similar outcomes, means that the way you treat people is different. And that you may need to treat people differently in order to ensure that everybody then has the chance of having the same or similar outcomes. So it's a real shift and kind of a nuanced shift for people to grasp. And mm-hmm. and so, you know, we spend a lot of time doing that. And what we find in terms of building buy-in is that you have to sort of find who are the key people to talk to. Like, who's the supervisor that everybody follows what that supervisor says? Or who is the community leader who won't let you have access to anybody in the community unless you sort of convince them? And so some of that six-month time period is really trying to find who those people are, and that takes you start to figure that out very quickly as you do these presentations and meet with folks.
And can you say a little bit more about how you identify those folks? You say it happens quickly, which I believe, but what do you see that leads you to say, well, this person's one of these people we want to talk to?
Yeah. You know, it's an iterative process. It's generative. So you go out and you'll have a meeting with a group of leaders, and you'll explain the process to them, and then you'll say, who else should we talk to help make sure that this process runs as smoothly as possible? And with that first meeting, you usually get a huge list of people, just even asking, because they all, you know, especially supervisors or people close to the ground. When we were working in Los Angeles recently, they said, there's just no way you could even do this until you go to the Black Community Task Force. Mm-hmm. And this task force is a group of advocates, sort of scrappy, wonderful advocates that very much protect the community in South Los Angeles.
Mm.
And so we went to one of their meetings and basically got grilled by them about what is this process. And they wanted to know, who are we to come into their community to do that? And so spending a lot of time having open, honest dialogue with them, not racing through, not pushing our agenda, but being responsive to what their concerns are, was our approach. And it worked wonderfully. And then they opened the door for us to meet people we would not have met otherwise, and to talk to families that we wouldn't have found otherwise.
And how do you prepare a team to, like, look at the them? So now you've laid some groundwork and you've got some things ready to go. How do you get that team then ready to do the analysis and look at the practice and all of those things, and to maintain that sort of what we think of in the old world as audit attitude, meaning that, you know, that inquiry, that stance of inquiry and learning the system. How do you prepare a team to do that around these more sensitive, well, I guess
sure.
They're all sensitive issues, but.
Well, I could say also, we spend a lot of time with local leadership identifying who should be on the team. We don't want to just have it be our staffs that come in, our people from the outside who come in to do this work. We want some people with local, you know, sometimes it's a combination of our staff and then people on the ground. Sometimes it's our staff and another group that's providing technical assistance, but we also have people on the ground who live there, who work there, who know the community, because it's just not going to be successful unless you have that. But also we also try to make sure our teams are incredibly diverse in racially, gender, age, types of experience, so that not everybody is from one system, for example. And
but within the community, you mean?
What was that?
You mean within the community, you're looking for that kind
of
diversity.
Yeah, mm-hmm, absolutely. And also on our team, like the team mm-hmm. that we bring in as well. But it just wouldn't be successful if we had a whole white team going mm-hmm. in and looking at the African-American community.
Mm-hmm.
Same with recently we were doing one looking at Latino youth in the juvenile justice system, and the team was heavily African-American with a few white people. But what we realized before we went in was that we had to bring in a lot more people who were bilingual, bicultural. So we brought in 9 more people who were bilingual, bicultural. So that there's a composition to the team, and to sort of lend legitimacy and access to the community as well. So we spend that time, but then preparing the team. So we spend some time. We train the team over a 2-day period on what this whole process is, and we have them do a lot of skill building. So we train them on the overall concepts of what the institutional analysis is, but a lot of skill building and a lot of actual practice. being in an interview and asking questions, but also what we call sort of the lean-in, that it's amazing when you start to interview people, the things that come out of folks' mouth. And you may have experienced it as well. But the things, so, you know, one of the times I was doing an interview, this man says to me, and I'm African-American, he says to me that you must know, in the African-American community, it's cultural, black men don't believe in fatherhood. And so this was his concept about black people that I found quite offensive. Mm-hmm. And you hear this all the time in different ways. And people feel very comfortable because when you're a very skilled interviewer, people actually will tell you a lot of stuff. But we practice what we call the lean-in, where you just lean in and say, can you tell me a little bit more about that? Because we're not trying to get at this person's individual biases. What we're trying to understand is how the system is organized in a way that allows him to act on his individual biases.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we have reviewers fighting with people, debating people, it's not going to work. So we spend a lot of time with people on that. Then, but sort of the most critical piece is that we really try to ground our team in what we call the lived experience of the population that we're looking at. So we spend a lot of time either before the training or before we actually do the data collection, doing what we call case reviews, where we select a small number of cases and interview everybody who's a part of the case, including the children, the parents, if the children are not living with their parents, whomever they're living with, the social workers, the advocates, the judges, the lawyers, anybody we can find. So I'll give you know, in the jurisdiction we just finished recently, we looked at 8 cases and we conducted about 79 different interviews for those 8 cases. We present, and that way you get the voices of the families. You get to know the case better than anybody who's individually working the case, because you see how these different institutions are all working or not working together, and the effect that that has on the family and what the family actually needs. So we present those cases using the voice, you know, using real quotes from the kids and families. So using their language to describe what's happening to them for the team, so the team can start to hear and get grounded in the lived experience. Because oftentimes, we can't sort of help it in some ways. People categorize people, think about people in a particular way, and may have preconceptions of who this community is, who these families are, that completely gets upended once you get into the whole process of looking at these cases.
How do you deal with, I presume that people have a variety of reactions, including emotional reactions to those realities. How do you deal with that in your teams as you go through this process?
Yeah. That's a very good question. I know. So one of the things, we are, through this work and by looking at what happens with a particular population, that's a population that is disenfranchised in many, many ways. So while you may be looking at how they're processed through the criminal justice system or through the child welfare system, these are families that also experience oppression in some ways, from poverty, from the housing, the access to jobs. It's a larger societal issue that individual systems then are trying to grapple with. And then once you get into the meat of these cases, you really what you're seeing is how built into the structures of this country, racism is allowed to flourish. And it's unintended oftentimes, but it flourishes. And so really helping people, it always happens around Wednesday, right? We go in for a full week to collect data, and Monday everybody's all ginned up, ready to go, all excited, revved up. By Monday afternoon they realize, after they've done their first set of interviews, that this is like scary and a little harder than they thought. By Tuesday they're just getting tired. By Wednesday something happens where they realize, oh my gosh, I can't believe I have 2 more days of this, and how depressing is this? So around Wednesday, we pause and talk to people about how they're feeling and how they're doing. And we encourage people throughout the week to take care of themselves because of how hard it is. We've had people end up in the hospital because of the stress that they've taken on and what they've seen. We did this 1 year when H1N1 broke out, and two of our reviewers ended up with H1N1, I think because their systems were so, you know, distraught by this whole thing. Mm-hmm. I don't mean to scare people, but it's just, it's something that I, as sort of a worker bee, didn't think initially to attend to. But after you have so many reviewers start to drop, you realize that it can't just be that, you know, people get sick, but that people are internalizing a lot of the racism that they're structural racism that they're seeing and experiencing as well.
I'm wondering if anyone out there has any questions that they'd like to ask at this point in time.
And please feel free, push the number 1 on your keypad, and Stephanie will help you get into this discussion. Or you're certainly welcome to email liz@praxisinternational.org. If you have any questions or comments or experiences that you'd like to share here, please feel free. While we're waiting, I had a couple, maybe a comment and a question myself. One is that you referenced that you do this in 1 week, and typically we're familiar with assessments that will go for 6 months, 8 months, so you really do spread that out. Not to say that you wouldn't have this need for team care, but it might look differently if that was spread out. Do you think that the 1 week kind of intensive that you're doing has something to do with it, or would you have any suggestions if this is pulled out into a 4 month or 6 month process?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the 1 week may definitely have something to do with it. I mean, it's the price you pay in some ways. Why we tend to do it in 1 week is that you get everybody's full attention for that 1 week. They're not balancing a bunch of different jobs, but we pull them from their jobs to do it in 1 week, and oftentimes that works better for jurisdictions.
Mm-hmm.
And we also do it in 1 week because of how quickly the data builds on each other and people forget over time. Oh. Sometimes, you know, when there's a lag. And so there's a real energy that comes from doing it with 1 week. But I also think you're right, you know, then you're immersed in it all, right? So you're learning it all and you're immersed in it all, but at the same time then you're getting exhausted and kind of overwhelmed by all of this.
And the processing time is certainly cut down to be able to take it and sit on it and think about it and
right.
put it where
no.
you need to, yeah.
Well, and, you know, we did, one day we did, we had people talk about their, in one of the jurisdictions we worked in, people talk about the dreams that they were having.
Wow.
And I remember this one woman saying how she had a dream that she stood up and she had an assault weapon and just started shooting everybody.
Oh, my.
You know, this is the most mild-mannered woman you've ever met. But you could just, but also it just spoke to how angry she was feeling about what she was seeing.
Mm-hmm.
And then, and so it's that kind of thing that we need to process, but also, the language, which is true, I think, in all assessments, but when you really start to pay attention to the language of the community that is being used to describe people in this community, it gets grating. And also it can be hard that people realize that they have been using that language themselves, right, if they're from the community. So, for example, you know, you'll see labeled in case files, people will talk about how they were described to their face as hostile, or that they were described as being psychotic or aggressive or noncompliant, or that they don't care about their kids. But when you really then, so that's the label, but then when you look at through the files or you interview people for what are the facts to back up that label, you can't find them.
Mm.
Or the lens is wrong, right? So this aggressiveness that we were hearing a lot was to describe mothers, and they were described as aggressive, and then the way workers interacted with them was to posture in some ways or bring in extra workers to protect themselves. But these were women who had their children removed from them, oftentimes unexpectedly,
mm-hmm.
And that they had trusted that they were working with the system, and then the system suddenly removes their kids.
Yeah.
And they removed them often. You know, one woman was nursing, and they removed the baby from her arms, you know, in the middle of the night with a SWAT team that came in to remove the kids. And so she was screaming, and I mean, who wouldn't in some way scream and yell like that? But she was screaming, fighting with the SWAT team that was removing this baby, all this kind of stuff. And when she came to court the next day, she was still distraught and screaming. And so, her label of aggressive never left throughout the 3 years that she had this case filed.
Wow.
You know, yeah, so that's helping people understand that they're using that language, but they may be using that language inappropriately.
Mm-hmm. I was in a community not too long ago where an official described that the women in that community are very violent. So there's a narrative going on along with, you know, whatever systems are working. So, yeah.
Yeah.
So,
I should also just say that what we do every night is debrief with the team. So we're doing this week-long blitz, and we divide people into teams to do this. And every night we work late, right, because people are the expectation is in order to get the work done. And at the end of then, we do a fishbowl where the team sits, and we invite anybody from the leadership who wants to come and listen or help provide clarification from what we're hearing, listen to us talk as a team about what we've heard or learned from going out and collecting data. And we always begin by talking about the lived experience so that we're grounding people in the voices of a population that they may not be a part of, and helping them understand that.
Can you maybe elaborate on that a little bit, Kristen? I think we throw out that idea, the lived experience.
Sure.
And it isn't, I just think to ground us in that a little bit more would be good.
Yeah. So the way we... Oh, go ahead.
Kristen, I wonder if I can just interject. This is Liz. We do have a question in the operator queue. And so, Cheryl, I don't know if you want Kristen to finish her response or if you'd like...
No, go to the question. I think that's
okay.
Good.
All right. Very good. Stephanie, will you open that caller's line, please?
Yes, we do have Blueprint for Safety. Your line is now open.
Hello, this is Mrs. Tennessee's Blueprint for Safety Project, and I have with me a couple of our lieutenants that are over the DV units here in Memphis, both Shelby County and Memphis. And when you mentioned about how to treat people differently so that you can get racial equity, they both were very concerned about that because policy and procedure is, you know, you treat everybody the same, that we do need this racial neutrality. And so both wondering, could you speak a little bit more about that?
Sure.
Who makes the determination of who to get treated differently and how that different treating should be? Because we've worked for years to be able to be equal here, and that's kind of a new concept that
we
need to hear a little bit more about.
Well, so let me just take it first out of the racial context, then we can go take it back there. But so think about, so when I'm talking about equity, I'm talking about things like, so the good example of the crash test dummies. So crash test dummies are built on a particular model of a particular person, but it's used to assess safety in general for all cars. So, oftentimes, like, you're buying a car based on the safety rating, but when you unpack it and really figure it out, that safety rating may not apply to you because the crash test dummy is somebody who's 5'7 or 5'8 and 170 pounds. So, for, a very short, like a 5'2, 90-pound woman, that car is not safe. Actually, you don't know if that car is safe for them or not. It may not work for them. So that's just an example of equity versus equality. So when you're looking at it sort of in the racial context, what we're saying is that race, there's nothing actually that is neutral, that policies are, and that's not bad. I'm not saying that that's good or bad one way or the other, but that policies are based on the concept of a particular person, and you have to get to the bottom of that. So, for example, there's, and I'll take it out of the sort of legal context, but in a community we're working in right now, there is a race-neutral policy that in order to play on a sports team for kids, the parents have to take a concussion class. And what we found was that parents of color weren't able to take the concussion class because of the way that the class was offered. So the class was offered only online and only in English. so, again, that goes to an equity fairness thing. There's the assumption that parents in this community all have access to computers and all speak English and have a general literacy level that can do this. So what they were finding is, and where it was inequitable, was that only in this community that their sports teams were 95% Caucasian. And when you backed it up, it wasn't because African-American and Latino kids didn't want to play. It was because of this concussion training rule and regulation. Does that help somewhat?
Maybe she's gone.
Well, we kind of like to bring it back around more to how would that affect policies that relate to, say, like a DV arrest?
Yeah. So I am less familiar with being able to give you an example around the DV arrest, but where I can give it to you around is a juvenile justice case that we just looked at recently. So it's not about whether or not, if somebody's committed a crime, this is not about whether or not you arrest them, but what happens afterwards. So in this juvenile, in this county, Fairfax County, where we're recently working, upon arrest, kids are taken to a central processing place, and they can either be released to their parents or they can be detained. And they have a structured decision-making tool that is used to determine if they can go home or they can be detained. And it's pretty, you know, it's based on the offense. They spent a lot of time gearing it towards, calibrating it towards seeing who is more likely to be violent, who's more likely, it's not safe to have them home or not. But then there's an override feature that you can use at discretion to keep kids locked up or not. And what we found was that override discretion was often used to keep kids of color locked up, and that the reason was that their parents couldn't get to them in time because they only had a two-hour window to get to them if they were going to take them home that night. And so it's not about the whole processing piece, you know, is it right to arrest or not, is it, you know, how they come out on that checklist. It's what happens, how it's interpreted, how that checklist is used or not used.
I think with regard to DV arrests and the example that you used earlier, Kristen, about the mother who had her child removed and so was responding in a very what the people she was responding to turned aggressive, and then extrapolating from that set of behaviors to making some other determination about how she might be treated is another kind of instance, I think, where kind of trying to take the lived experience into account when dealing with, you know, when making decisions that are designed to be equal, just to recognize that as human beings, we don't respond to all those situations in an equal manner.
This is Lieutenant Shelton. My concern about that is what information was given to the police that they would even have brought the SWAT team? Because we don't just go into a house with a bunch of guns to take a child out. So what information was given to them that led them to believe that they were in a dangerous situation, that there was possibly some sort of armed conflict going to happen or could happen?
Well, so that's a great question, and I wish that more jurisdictions were organized like your jurisdiction, but in this jurisdiction, which was in Michigan, they use SWAT teams. They always use police to remove children, and they use SWAT teams to remove children at night who are in particular neighborhoods. And so this neighborhood, this family was homeless and living in a temporary motel, but that was just how they do it. And then they go out with social workers and they remove in that way. And so there was a call actually subsequently in the community to end the use of SWAT teams as a regular way of removing children.
Well, and isn't that, this is Lucy, isn't that the the idea behind an institutional analysis, that you're looking at the steps, you're looking at how the case is processed from the beginning phone call all the way through, or whatever your window that the question is leading you to. But it's in looking at those policies, looking at the practices, looking at each step, and then asking those questions.
That's right.
And out of that come learning about that this is a standard practice that police go in for removal of a child. That's just something for the group to talk about, to examine, to say, all right, how is that interpreted? Is there any racial disparity? How is that affecting people? What is it about the way that the system is working that works or doesn't work? Does it increase safety? Doesn't it? Those kinds of questions are what this whole process is designed to do, and I think you just touched on a little bit then, to come up with some recommendations, some actions, some ways that this team can look at that.
That's right. And I should also say that the way that they used the SWAT team was to look at some of the crimes, and which were more sort of violent neighborhoods, and also then they were using around temporary hotels. But what they ended up doing was using it particularly and predominantly communities of color, predominantly African American communities. But that community was neighbored another white community that was had struggling a lot with poverty issues and had a very, very similar crime rate. But what had happened was sort of the lure had taken off, and the perception in the media was such that this is a more violent community than the neighboring Caucasian community. It wasn't until we went to the sheriff to actually get the crime statistics that they realized that there was actually this similarity, and that perhaps the SWAT team approach was not being used equally, you know, the same actually in both communities.
Mm-hmm. And it's that lived experience that really helps us figure out how these things come about in terms
right.
of policy and protocol. Kristen, I wonder if maybe we could kind of move from this analysis piece and discussion of it to what comes about, how does change come about once you've done the analysis, you've looked at some issues, you may or may not have made recommendations, but things are coming out. How does it then become a change in a community?
Sure. I mean, in a couple of different ways. So first, while we're on the ground doing the analysis, we have this real-time debriefing sessions that I was describing. And we invite, again, whomever to sit in. And so real-time, people are hearing what's happening and actually correcting things, right, as we're, you know, what are sort of things that they didn't know or easy fixes. Things like policy mythology, we call it, where people think that something's been a policy forever. When we ask to see the written policy, nobody can produce it, and it turns out it's a myth. Mm-hmm. And so directors pretty much on the spot can correct things right away. Or, for example, again, this is back to Michigan, there were community providers that weren't going into this African-American neighborhood. And the CEOs of the community providers knew it, that they weren't providing what they were contracted to do, which is to go in and provide in-home support services to families. They were asking these families to come out to them because they were worried about their safety. But again, when you looked at the safety data or the crime data, it was very similar with this white community that they were sending workers in and providing in-home services to. So the director that week we were there sent demand letters to the CEOs and met with them right after we left to do that. So there's some real-time things that can happen. And sometimes it's on an individual case level, but oftentimes it's this agency kind of piece, or clarifying policies. But then at the very end of our week on the Friday, before we leave, we make a formal presentation of what we call very, very, very preliminary findings because we haven't gone through all the data yet. But some of the themes that have come up, and that usually is bigger than the people who've sat in on the debrief, meaning a bigger audience, and involves multiple agencies, advocates, community leaders, other folks who come and hear what we have, what we've said. In that way, we're not leaving with all the knowledge and then waiting however many months it takes us to finalize a report to give to them. They have this information right away, and every community that we've left starts working pretty much based on what they've heard. It may be little things, but they always start to work. We ask that there's a leave behind person, either a member of the investigation team, an accountability body of people who maybe are the people who what the report is going to sit with, who have maybe been advising us all along. There's some body, either a group of people or individual, who is tasked with trying to keep the momentum going. And then we spend a lot of time going through data on our end and coming up with a report. And we change our reports depending on what the needs of the community is, because we don't want to release a report that would be destructive to a community. We're not going to release a report that says the way that this whole entire system is organized, is horrible for Black families. We're just not going to do that. But what we want to do is release it in a way that's constructive. And so I would say the last several reports that we've released, I can't even tell you how many, they've always been joint endeavors with the local jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we have our logo and their county seal on it. We have our report, and embedded in our report is their action plan, no matter how preliminary it is, so that there's a response right there. We do joint press releases, whatever they feel is necessary. And in Fresno County, where we worked, the director was worried about her board of supervisors and how they would take the report. And so she and her group spent a lot of time meeting with community leaders, the people she contracted with to provide services, other agencies. And so when the report was released and she was called to task by the Board of Supervisors, she brought over 100 people to that meeting in support of the work and in support of moving forward on this. And so it went quite well. And, in fact, they have a very bad press. The press is very unfavorable to their child welfare system there, but had done enough groundwork that she got a neutral report from the press, which is considered to be a big success there.
I'm wondering if there are any questions out there or follow-up questions from previously. I realize you didn't ask that, especially from our group from Memphis, if there were other things you wanted to ask.
And if you're not on the line, you might have to do star one and come back through Stephanie, which is fine.
Can you hear us?
Yes.
I believe we're okay now. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And just a quick little correction. If you would like to get into the question queue, you can press the number 1 on your phone.
Oh, did I say?
You said that other thing. Don't say it again, Lucy.
Don't say it again. All right. So I do have some questions. I'm thinking about the traditional approach to the community assessments is perhaps through a CCR. There's just been so much work done in the last number of years about building community coordinated responses and CCR teams, and very often the assessments will come out of the work of that group who maybe wants to look at a specific question or something that's happening in their community. So it might be a little bit different coming in from the outside, but if that CCR chose to take on a question, say, about racial disparity or one of these other very complex topics, and I come from a very small town. I'm speaking to you from Montana, a very small area. I'm going back to selecting the team and how you do that when so often racial groups might be a very, very small minority and represented on the team, represented in the practitioner community or the systems that they work with. Do you have any recommendations? What would look different, or what can you think of about coming from a team that's already organized?
Yeah, you know, so we actually have entered in where teams are already organized and brought in new people just to shake up that team. Because oftentimes there's with teams that have been together for a while, there are entrenched behaviors and sort of perceptions of each other, good or bad. But by bringing in a bunch of sort of new people for a particular purpose, that's been helpful. We've also brought in people for political reasons, right? So we, in Fairfax County, we were looking, when we were looking at the juvenile justice system, we brought in a major who was part of the police department. We brought in people from the schools who were in the schools were turned out to be the number one feeder into the juvenile justice system. So we brought in people because we wanted to influence other systems, even though this was coming out of juvenile probation, that system. They brought in, and they had been together for a long period of time, they brought in other people. They brought in people from Parks and Recs.
Wow.
Because some of it was a lack of prevention programming. And this group had a hint that that was what it was. So they brought in people, and they brought in people from child welfare, even though it's juvenile justice, because they knew that there was an overlap in those kids. But they brought in these folks, one, to add diversity, but two, because ultimately after the whole process was completed, they wanted those people to be able to influence those agencies that they were a part of.
So for this idea of buy-in and people feeling comfortable with this idea of a team going through their work practices, reading case files, listening to 911 recordings, that sort of thing, can be unnerving, if not totally intimidating. And when you add that overlay of now we're going to look at an issue like race or class, or it seems like buy-in is going to be a tough. You know, how do you do that respectfully to say now we're going to also open up your files to people from these outside groups?
Right.
That just seems like,
yeah.
Oh,
well,
it's pretty scary.
I can't say, you know, there are always, there are people who are, you know, like the upfront, the people who say, just look and tell me what's going on, or help us figure it out. You're going to have some of those people. You're going to have some of the people who are sort of like, I'll do whatever my leader tells me to do. And then you're going to have the people who you can't convince till you, no matter what kind of thing. But you kind of, what has worked for us is to rely on the quantitative data and to really ask, to really reiterate, this is not a comparison study. We're not trying to look at black kids and white kids, or black mothers and white mothers, to see what's the difference between the two. What we're looking at is we're taking data to say, and we're saying, if you look at your data, the outcomes are worse for this population, and it breaks out usually around race. Sometimes it's a combination of race and gender, or race and mental health, race and drug addiction. There can be a combination of things, but usually it's around race. And then we're saying, we're just going to look at this population because they're faring the worst. And if we can work on improving outcomes for this population, this can improve populations' outcomes for everybody. There's this, you know, there's some research out there that talks about just sort of universal work to improve systems maintains and sometimes actually expands the racial disparity in terms of outcomes, so that you may be improving, you know, a rising tide lifts all boats is the saying, but if you do program improvement, you've raised everybody's boat, but you still maintained the disparity. What we're saying is, let's just focus on the population that's it's worse for, and try to improve their lot and influence what's happening with the system, so that they are better served and that they have better outcomes, and see if that then rises all boats. Does that make sense?
Kind of. So
one question I have Kristen, as sort of related to this, what you're talking about, I think, in terms of how the team forms its question seems like one of the ways in which you're sort of informing a community and at the same time engaging that community in this. And it seems like, the, as always, the whatever the assessment, the institutional analysis question is, helps inform the work. Maybe you could talk about that a little bit.
Sure, sure. You know, so we look, as I was saying earlier, we're asking people to look at their data and seeing, so again, I'll bring up our Fairfax example because that's where we've looked at one of the most recent places. And we were looking at their arrest data, who got arrested, and it was around juvenile justice, and that, and then who was detained, and who got released. And what we were finding were higher arrests for African-American and Latino kids, but a lot of that was because of, it wasn't that they shouldn't have been arrested, it was that they came to the attention of the police, and a lot of it was through the schools, and then they ended up getting arrested. But what was more in control of the agency that was asking for this process was whether or not they got detained and how long they were on probation for. And so they were interested in not the arrest data that they didn't have control over, but they were interested in the data that they did have some control over, which was this dispositional kind of what happens after the arrest piece. And that there were a lot of disparities there. And so, we looked at the quantitative data and we talked to their leadership group, and then they decided they wanted to look at this front door and what was happening around sort of why they couldn't send kids home or why kids had to stay in a locked facility for a while.
So it came from the data specifically. And when you say kids, do you mean all the kids, or did they break it out by racial groups or by...
Yeah, so they broke... We looked at data in Fairfax by race and gender, and because it looked different. So there was actually a really high arrests for Latino girls and compared to African-American girls. And so we spent some time really looking at what was going on with girls as opposed to African-American boys. When we looked at the African-American population separately, we spent some time looking at African-American boys. So we followed the quantitative data, but we also followed the worries of the leadership. And leadership was worried about girls and Latino girls and boys because they kind of knew this all along. They didn't need their quantitative data necessarily to support it. The leadership didn't need it, but everybody else we talked to needed it. So by collecting that quantitative data ahead of time, when you're going out and saying, we're looking at this population, when people ask you why, you can say their outcomes are the worst. Here's what the data show. And so we move forward with that. But again, saying this is not a comparison. We're not looking for any individual racism. We're just trying to understand how institutions are able to respond well or not well to the needs of this population. I mean, so what came out astonishingly, but probably not surprisingly, around looking at Latina girls was that they're caught up in these undocumented households, and what happens when half of your family is in the process of being deported. There are all these nuances in terms of their relationship with police and authority that look different than African-American kids when we were looking doing the African-American kids. But being able to describe from their lived experience what it's like to worry about ICE banging on your door in the middle of the night, what is it like to live in a boiler room because your parents are undocumented, you don't qualify for Section 8 housing. There's very limited affordable housing in the area, so you're part of a three or four families living in a single family home. And all that lived experience, we were able to to come out and enhance then this quantitative data that we started with.
And you made a comment earlier, Kristen, about that the data kind of builds on itself. And is what you just described an example of that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So we'll start with, because we always start, again, as I said, with a lived experience. So when we're following different cases, so again, and I'll use Fairfax as an example. One of the cases I actually looked at, we used right from the very beginning, which was a gal who was depressed and in the summer had gained 65 pounds and was cutting herself. And the reason she was caught up in the juvenile justice system was for truancy, and she had been involved in a domestic incident with her boyfriend. And so we just used that information then to explore do other interviews, which led us to, so as we were going and out and asking questions around the mental health needs of Latina girls and how they were being helped or not helped, what we came to find out was that there is actually a youth survey that's conducted in the county yearly, and that youth survey found that 1 out of 4 Latina girls self-report being significantly depressed. And 1 out of 6 or something had reported suicidal ideation, but that there's significant depression going on, not just in this one case that I found, but countywide, or for the girls who live in that county. But that then we start to follow up to see, are there therapists available? Are there group counseling sessions available for them? And we didn't find any of that meaningful therapy available to them, and that there were no parenting support classes that were offered in Spanish for working with, for if you had an adolescent, that there were plenty of sort of parenting classes and supports in Spanish if you had kids under the age of 3, but nothing for this teenage population.
Yeah.
So it just starts to, so you're trying to figure out how are systems organized to support this Latina gal and her mom, who she was living with, and you can find her mom wasn't supported, she wasn't supported, and then you start to, through the data and your analysis, understand how that comes about.
It's a really good example of how the line of inquiry kind of follows from that lived experience to how far you can take that with regard to this young woman who reports being depressed, and how far you can take that with regard to the disparity and how it came about in that community. Fascinating.
And so in the child welfare system, that leads you one place. If that was in the criminal justice system, you might not get exactly there in terms of needing all these other social systems, social support systems or agencies involved. I'm kind of thinking about Memphis as we're saying this, but if you are looking at your 911 or at your law enforcement response, I hope that you can translate this into the kinds of policies that are operating, or the kinds of case processing that happens where people can fall through the cracks, or their everyday needs that are impacting their relationship with the system are not being met, and that's exacerbating or changing how the system responds to that or can respond to that.
We're kind of coming near the end of our time together, and I'm wondering if there are any other questions out there at this point in time.
Cheryl, this is Liz. I had a question for Kristen about the final report that I would assume that the Center for Social Policy provides at the end of your kind of analysis, your week within a community. What does that all contain, that report that you would leave with the community itself?
Oh, yeah. So we don't – so we orally or verbally present a report on that Friday, but then we turn out a written document later on. And it depends on sort of, again, the political lay of the land, that we don't want to drop a bomb in a community after we've done such delicate work. We want it to be a mechanism or a catalyst for their ability to continue the work that they've done over time by bringing us in. So in some communities, we've provided two different documents, what we call a local management workbook. So it would be sort of a highly detailed list of everything that we found and how it's more of like we found this policy and that this policy wasn't being implemented in this way, or this form, this particular form, doesn't account for the reality or the particular circumstances of this community. So it's really sort of granular, very detailed piece, and then a broader community-wide, more public document about what are the broad themes that we found. So that's been one approach that we've done. Another thing is just to not even have that kind of level of detail for the big final document. So when we did in Iowa, their leadership felt that that their work with the community was such that they needed more of the finger pointed at what the community can do and how the community could be mobilized to support their work, and less at what was going on with the agency. So that report, we changed the we shifted it around in some ways so that it led with the community and how the community could support programming around substance abuse treatment that was more racially equitable, mental health services, other kinds of components, and ended with what has to happen internally with the child welfare agency. So we spend a lot of time thinking with and working with the leadership in terms of how do you package the data in an honest way that is useful to them in moving the work forward, not undermining the efforts to date.
I just want to add, I found it really instructive just to read. I think I was reading your report from Fresno, and just reading the report is really, you learn a lot from about your process and what went on and how you do it. So very well done. Thanks.
And those institutionalysis reports, I think there's six of them on your website. Is at, that's www.cssp.org. And right on your homepage, there's the story behind the numbers. That's your report from Fairfax County, Virginia. And there are other reports, if folks wanted to look at them, are on that website under publications, child welfare, and then institutional analysis. So that's incredibly helpful and helpful there. So were there any other last questions? Any other kind of key recommendations or things that we should know, Kristen?
I would say just that that this is really critical work, and to not be afraid to do it, and that there will always be heated arguments along the way. It's because this is the work that you're doing is a microcosm of our larger society that we live in, but that how powerful it can be for communities to go through this process together. That we've seen communities really shift and really come to understand. So for example, in Fairfax County, the police were vilified a lot around the juvenile justice pieces. But after we did the institutional analysis with the cooperation and full participation of the police department, how much that shifted the community, particularly the African-American community's perception of the police and their willingness to understand and work with them on issues. And that's more than any single report could do. It's actually the process itself that does it. It's not the release of a report. So that it's it's a hard process, but it's an incredibly powerful, I would almost call it transformative process for some communities to go through.
That is very hopeful. It's a nice note. And I believe that's true, that as communities come together and with an openness to investigate what's happening and not with the idea to not blame, but to really try to figure this out, that really can be an avenue that for powerful change.
And builds that team that's on the same page, and ready to move forward. That's great. Well, that's about our time, kind of perfect timing here, but we want to remind you that to learn more about institutional analysis, you can always go to the Praxis website. That's at www.praxisinternational.org. And there is a logistics guide that's a manual for coordinators to use as they're going through the assessment process under our programs, institutional analysis and community assessments, under resources. The other thing you're going to find under resources is another assessment report, race equity review, which I think, Kristen, is from your Michigan work.
Right.
With child welfare, so... I want to thank both of you. This has been a huge topic and enough different that it's raising lots of challenges about how we can do this in ways that build community and bring folks together. And thank you for both of your work in doing this kind of very, very difficult analysis and moving this forward. So I'll remind everyone that the next month's networking call is on November 28th. That's going to be on community assessments in a large urban setting. So thank you all for participating and calling in, and we hope you can join us next month. Thank you.